We're here with Shalon and Gord at Fair Realty. Why don't you two tell us about yourselves and how you got into the realty business?
I got in the real estate industry in 2016. My parents were realtors, a lot of real estate in my family. I moved back to Canada and it was kind of an interest of mine that I always had. And once I kind of knew I wanted to stay in one place for good because I was a bit of a traveler, then I got my real estate license and haven't looked back since then and just kind of kept growing and expanding and bought an office and opened a second one along the way and recruited Gord as well. And yeah, it's been a great way to have a business here in the Shuswap and be around a ton of people all the time. You're always meeting people. You're always around people. And that's like exciting. And we're always, you know, traveling around, seeing different sites, seeing different houses. And I'm never bored. It's always interesting. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into it, I guess.
I got into it because it looks super easy and it looks like all you gotta do is dress nice, go to houses, show people, talk about it a bit, you know, give them some information on it, drive around, look at more houses. Like, it's pretty easy stuff and you just make lots of money, so why not do it?
Then you found out that was not the reality.
and then reality set in.
So, dude, tell us about the reality of it.
Oh, the reality of it. Well, you show up to a house and you're not looking very good because you didn't sleep well last night because you're up all night stressing about something. And then you get bit by the dog because it had rabies. So now you got to go to the hospital. And then meanwhile, your teammate's calling you because, you got to be showing up somewhere to let someone in with keys. And then the contract is missing some signatures, so then I got to run back and do that. And next thing you know...
I'd say the truth is somewhere in the middle of those two versions. But that's kind of how we've done our businesses. We do a lot of online marketing and stuff, and when we started our team, we wanted to do something different. We weren't quite sure. We hadn't been in front of the camera before, so it was a little bit awkward and stumbly. And then people were like, "We love your act. It's so awkward and stumbly and it's funny." And we were like, "Oh, it's not an act. That's just how bad we are." But it was kind of, that's what came natural. And so now we're kind of like, that's become our niche, is to inject some education and, you know, on the property or what we're doing or selling, but at the same time, make it a little bit funny so that it's something interesting for people to watch, because otherwise there's just one more video of a nice house with elevator music and everybody's seen that a million times. So that's kind of our...
Yeah, people can relate with not perfect.
Yeah.
And between a realtor and sellers, how many other people are involved in that process?
Almost everybody. Like, you can name something that you think is obscure and that has no business in a real estate transaction. But I mean, we've had to call bat removal specialists. We've had to
pick up dog poo
people. All the regulars, like your lawyers and your home inspectors and your plumbers and all of your builders and all of your contracting trades. We deal with all of them. And then it's
photographer. We got assistants. We got conveyancers. We've got hair and makeup.
Yeah, there's like between the seller and the realtor, we have a whole team in order to do a listing and sell a listing. And that, you know, it's a complete effort. Like, you can't get there on your own. Like, every member of the team is a part of it. But yeah, when it comes to just the stuff, then once the listing is live that we have to deal with it, you never know. Sometimes we're calling engineers to ask about all sorts of things. Like, every time we think this is the craziest thing I've ever seen, people will say, "Okay, well, we'll buy the chickens with the farm, but we need to find out, you know, what kind of chickens are these?" And so we're going to have to go and find that information.
And then when the bank hears about it, they don't want to fund it because they don't want to have chickens in that.
Yeah, so we have to be creative with stuff like that too. So the chickens are worth a dollar. We sell a lot of, like, with recreational properties, a lot of times they come turnkey. So all of the furnishings, right down to every dish, knife, spoon, fork, you name it, all the sheets on all the beds and everything. A lot of times we'll sell them with the boats too. We've sold cats with the property. We put a dog in on offer once.
I've offered to push Shalon in a pool for a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her favorite place when we go, so it's funny because when we go and look at a house, like, you know, we all have to walk around and look at the kitchen and back. She's in the crawl space. Like, she goes immediately to the crawl space and she needs to check out the underbelly of the house.
I wouldn't say it's immediately, and not every house has a crawl space, but if there is one, I will take a look at it to make sure. Because you never know, you might find rats in the crawl space or something.
Have you?
Yeah. Both alive and dead.
At least it was just rats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We haven't found a bear yet.
No.
But we have had bears when we've been on listing shoots that are hanging around next door and stuff.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say turnkey, that means a house full of stuff?
Yeah.
And you have to itemize every item?
Sometimes it's too much. Like, we've had some people come to us sometimes and say, I am leaving with the contents of this room and absolutely everything else in the house is staying. That's how you're selling it. And, I mean, the crackers were still in the cupboard. The milk was still in the fridge. And sometimes there's estate sales, too. And the person who inherits the estate doesn't want to deal with any stuff. But the buyers might also not want the stuff. So then we have a series of people to help as far as, you know, cleaners, junk collectors, antique people come in sometimes because sometimes there is stuff of value. And then we have people who will sell stuff on Facebook and Marketplace. And a lot of times our clients, if they don't always want to deal with it themselves or they have no family that can help them, we're the ones organizing all that too.
Finding the movers and getting them boxes and driving them to the store.
And one of the funnier things is with real estate, somebody has to be of sane capacity, basically, to be in a legal binding contract. If they don't have capacity, they can't be in a legal binding contract. Makes sense. We have to get that question answered more often than you think. And it's not always, you know, sometimes somebody's, you know, there's a little bit of dementia or something like that. So we have to make sure that their family is helping them. But is their family helping them or is their family taking advantage of them? So we have to assess the whole situation and make sure, has there been a lawyer involved here? Has a doctor said that this person needs a power of attorney or something like that? So those are all questions we ask too.
So you do a certain amount of discernment and listen to your intuition where there might be some red flags.
Yeah, we walk away from a lot of listings because sometimes it's just, or buyers where you just, you know, sometimes you can put your finger on it, sometimes you can't, but you know there's something not quite right. And sometimes people don't want to tell you something about the house that they know it'll be like there wasn't permits done or something like that. And they're like, it's okay, it's fine. The realtor doesn't need to know, but it's our job to ask. And then if they tell us something like, well, you don't need to know that, then that's kind of a red flag for us saying, well, we can't put ourselves on the line here. If you're not being honest, then we can't. This transaction's not going to end well for anybody.
We're giving extreme cases, of course.
Yeah.
Times out of 10, the people are gold and it's just really nice working with them.
But those won't make great stories. Yeah. And on the opposite side, buyers are a lot of fun because what people sometimes come to you with what they want and what they need and what they buy can be three completely different things. And sometimes their criteria, for example, I had one set of buyers once that came to me and they said, our main criteria is that our pot-belly pigs have to be allowed. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, in where they had bought a house before, they bought in a community that had a bylaws in place that said you can't have farm animals because this is a like residential city subdivision. And pigs are one of those things that are considered farm animals. Pot-belly pigs are a little bit iffy because people have them as pets. But they actually bought this house and the bylaw officer came and said, you know, your neighbors have said you've got pigs. You can't have those pigs here. They didn't get rid of the pigs. They sold the house because the pigs were the pets. So when they went to buy the next house, that was the criteria that they gave me, was that if our pigs can't be here, we won't buy it. So I had to search through every bylaw. And if it was questionable, I had to contact them and say, does farm animals include potbelly pigs that are indoors? And half the time, nobody could answer me. So, yeah.
That's not a run-of-the-mill question.
No, it's not. So, yeah, that's one of the more interesting ones I've had.
So do some people change houses like you would change
your underwear?
Yeah.
Yeah, some people do. You get people who tell you they've moved between 8 and 20 times in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, okay. And sometimes it's for work. And sometimes they just fix up houses and move on, or family grows, or whatever. And then you get people who have had the same house for 50 years. And their kids and their grandkids and their great-grandkids have all been in that home. And that can be a very emotional, huge change for them. And just starting to talk about staging, decluttering, packing up, they can get quite emotional and they don't even realize it ahead of time. Sometimes that's going to happen when they start to pack up a house like that.
So being a realtor is part business person, part therapist, part social worker, part
marriage counselor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of this do you get training for when you take your real estate?
None.
Zero.
You know, if you talk to a realtor that's been in the business for a while, they'll tell you some of this stuff. But a lot of times, you know, most people will watch Selling Sunset or something like that. And they'll go, I know all about real estate. I'm going to do great. This is going to be amazing. And, you know, several months in, they realize that that was the reality was not on the show. So we hear a lot of times people are surprised that there's not as much work-life balance. They can't choose when they want to work because people want to see houses on the weekends or after work. Clients will call you at any hours that they feel like it sometimes, and you can choose to answer or not. But if you don't answer your phone enough times, then you probably won't have those clients. So yeah, work-life balance, it's not that type of business. And if people get into it thinking that it's a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday in the beginning, they're kind of a little bit upset to find out that that's not what it is.
Yeah. So how long have you both been in the business?
3.5 years. And I started when I was 21.
I've been in, this will be my 8th year.
How much does a neighboring property or the neighbor affect the selling or buying of a house?
We've seen people sell due to the neighbors. We've seen people buy due to the neighbors.
I find a lot of neighbors, once they find out you're selling, then they come over and they tell them what they should be selling their house for because they want as much money for theirs when they eventually sell.
True.
So when we show up and they ask us what we think their house is worth and we have all the comps in the world, then they'll say, but my neighbor says I can get this much.
Yeah, and our response to that is always like, did your neighbor bring you a check? Because if they think that's an easy sale and that's a great deal at that price, then are they not buying it?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, true, yeah. But yeah, we've had places that if the neighbor is a hoarder or, you know, has maybe a lot of animals, there's been cases like that where a lot of loud animals. We had one guy who had a lot of ducks and roosters and they were all very loud. And it was hard to sell the empty lot next door because people were like, why is there a farm next door? I don't want to be beside that. And it was just a residential lot. We get some abandoned houses, and that was hard to sell once. We had just an abandoned house beside the house we were selling, and people kept wanting to know all about the abandoned house. And, you know, it's abandoned. We didn't have any answers for them. But that was, they were more interested in that and what was going to happen with that than they just couldn't. It's uncertainty. So if there's uncertainty in any way, people get a little bit freaked out. We've seen people sabotage the selling of a neighbor's property because they want their own family to buy it or something. Yeah.
Or there'd be the tenants that sabotage it.
The tenants will sabotage it.
Because they don't want to be kicked out.
Yeah. I've seen the tenants follow the buyers and the realtor around and tell them all sorts of horror stories that weren't true and do things like that. I had a guy once tell me that his neighbor, when he moved in beside this guy, and the other neighbors came over and they said, oh, you moved in beside Benny, hey? And she's like, good luck. And he was like, huh? And then he met Benny. And Benny was an interesting character. Benny didn't work above board. Benny did other things.
Right.
And he said, you know, he did sell and move. And he said, you know, he was friends with this guy. But he said he was also driving him crazy because he would go away for work and he'd come back and he'd be like, I swear that's not where I parked my car. I thought it was on the other side of the driveway. And then, you know, his neighbor would come and he'd be like, the neighbor, Benny, would say, hey, that milk in your fridge, that's like overdue, you know. And he'd say, what? And turns out the neighbor had all the keys to his house, and I don't even know, after he rekeyed it, somehow the guy got in anyways. But he would just tell him stuff and he'd say, yeah, the vegetables in your fridge are going off. You better check on that. And he would get home and he'd be like, oh my God. He said, he swears he would even, you know, he found out that his neighbor had taken his car at night for a joyride and brought it back to his
driveway. Not a bad idea.
And this guy knew how to do all this stuff. And he said, what made him decide to sell the house in the end. Like, there was a million stories, and I've encouraged him to write a book on it because it's so hilarious. And now he finds it hilarious that he's psychologically a little bit, like, doesn't, you know, wake up in the middle of the night. But he said he would wake up in the middle of the night at one point in time, and he could hear this grinding noise all the time. And he believes, and I want to check this because I know who owns the house now, but he believes that the neighbor was actually tunneling underground under his house somewhere. And he could hear this at night. And knowing this guy, I wouldn't be surprised because it could have happened. It could have happened. And he said he would turn up and the neighbor would have like all his camo gear on and he would be night vision goggles like in the bush behind the house. And then he'd be like, oh, we're just checking things out. And he'd be like, okay, Benny.
That doesn't sound like a bad neighbor to have.
Yeah, yeah. He kept an eye on him, maybe too close for his comfort, but he kept an eye on him.
Any idea how the new tenant's doing?
Well, Benny passed away a number of years later, and this guy moved, and now it's two new owners, and they know none of this history, like...
And no one's found the tunnel.
And nobody's found the tunnel, yeah, so, yet. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, my friends bought when the snow was still on the ground, and then when it melted, they're like, oh, here's where Hugh dumped all his stuff. And,
We had an offer once where they wanted a really quick completion, and I took it to my sellers and I said, this is everything you want. It's a great price and it's a great offer, and they want to move in at the end of the month, and they're like, we can't do that. And I said, well, why not? This is everything you guys told me you want. They're like, well, okay, but we have one stipulation. We have to be able to come back and take our pet cemetery and excavate all of the animals and remove them off the property, because these people are going to redo the backyard and they're going to dig up all of our pets. And they had like 10 pets buried back there. So we wrote in the contract that the buyers would not disturb the property for a certain amount of time, and the sellers would come back in that time and they would take all the remains of the pets before. Yeah, so that's how we did it.
Yeah.
We have people who have actual graves on their property too. And in the U.S., there's tax breaks if you have a grave on your property because you can get like a cemetery status. I don't know if that's a thing in Canada, but yeah.
But it would have to be someone who's registered dead, not missing.
probably, yeah.
So how long have you had the business downtown in Salmon Arm here on Hudson?
We started in Hudson in May 2020. And I had been looking at the space for a while, and I'd really liked it, and I thought about opening a second office, and I kept this building. It was yellow. It was beautiful. I just loved the side of the street it was on and everything. And all of a sudden, one day, I walked by, and there used to be, like, a yarn store in here. And then I walked by, and it was during the height of COVID, basically, and all of a sudden, I seen it was empty, and there was a sign on the door, I think a number. And I called it straight away, and I was like, I really want this, you know, like, and they were like, okay, well, we don't have a bunch of people lined up to open businesses right now in the downtown. And I said, great, I'll take it. We spent 2 years here, and then we moved to Lakeshore. We opened a bigger office there for a while, kind of when the real estate was really booming around here. And then after, I think we were there for about a year and a half, and it just wasn't the same feel. Like, this space felt right. You know, the realtors originally were like, we want more parking, and you know, this will be great to go down there. And it was next to Starbucks. And then, you know, the realtors were like, we don't need a big office. We miss being close to all the restaurants. And so we moved. This space came available again in December, and we moved back here in December. So, and then this rental office we've had since I started in 2016, and I bought it in 2019.
How do you find business in town?
It's amazing how different Salmon Arm versus, you know, Blind Bay, Sorrento, 25 minutes away is. Like, they're completely different. We're, you know, a lot better known probably in the Blind Bay area. And here, sometimes we have clients that call us and they're like, hey, do you list in Salmon Arm? We're like, yeah, we have an office in Salmon Arm. They're like, oh, okay, we know you from Blind Bay, but we didn't, you know. So it's kind of, it changes just that little bit of distance. The houses are different. The things you have to know are different. Like, you know, a lot of times we get people moving back and forth, you know, in or out of town and stuff like that, because it's a completely different lifestyle. So, yeah. But no, Salmon Arm is great. We were at the mayor's address the other day, and
It's a great town.
I love this little city. Yeah.
We all know that there was a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So how was business before, during, and after? What was that like?
Probably the opposite of what a lot of people experienced. Because real estate, it was very busy right before the pandemic, which people don't realize that it was like there was a huge bottleneck. The real estate was already set to be quite busy that year. And then when they shut everything down for the pandemic, they just suppressed the demand, but the demand was growing underneath the lockdowns. And then all of a sudden they allowed this working from home and dropped the interest rates. And then it just exploded because all of a sudden all these people who, you know, weren't going to buy could all of a sudden have their city job but move to the country. They could, you know, not have an apartment in the city anymore and have to commute to work. They could live out here, and with Starlink being, you know, fast Wi-Fi pretty much anywhere for anybody, it just completely exploded our real estate market. So the best probably years in almost the history of Canadian real estate were during the tail end of the pandemic. And then because the interest rates were so low too. And so then last year was the first year we started to see the raising rates. And normally we used to have a market that everybody listed in the spring, they sold during the summer, they took their markets off in the winter, and nothing happened in the winter. And the pandemic changed all of that. And it made it so that the market was based on the rates versus the weather. And now as we progressed last year, the interest rates went up over the summer, the sales went down, the fire started, and the sales went even further down. And so then now last fall has been probably our quietest fall. And now for the first time, we've had the highest supply we've had since pre-pandemic. And for the first time, people are saying, you know, now it's more of a buyer's market. However, the buyers are hindered by interest rates in a lot of cases too. So this is actually a normal market comparatively, but people just remember the peaks and how good it was 2 years ago. So that's kind of what it's hard for people to adjust to. But our business is, it's one of those businesses that you work as hard as you can when the market is up, because you know the market's not always going to be up. And so you have to save for a rainy day too. And that's real estate. You can't expect that it's steady like a salary, because it's not.
And did the fires last year have any effect on things?
Yeah, fires have a huge effect on insurance. Because if there's a fire burning within, if you've got a fire hydrant protected area, it's within a 25 kilometer radius, they will not give a new insurance policy. And if you have a fire burning in a non-fire hydrant protected area, it's usually a 50 kilometer radius. And then I think last year they bumped it all up to 50. So as a crow flies. So the fire might be in Seymour Arm, but in Salmon Arm, you couldn't get a new insurance policy. So it basically just stopped all deals from happening. People don't want to look at a house when everything's smoke, they can't see the view. And then they're always worried about, you know, well, I don't want to go to a place where it could potentially burn, which is not the case. Once it's burnt, it's burnt. And what we've noticed from previous times when we've had fires is the memory of the fire usually fades quite fast. But we've also never had a fire like we've had right in our backyard in the North Shoe Shop like last year, other than Mount Ida. So yeah, it takes some time for people to kind of recover and rebuild and everything like that. And you know, long-term effects, like it doesn't matter where you go, natural, you know, disasters are a part of life, whether it's fires, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, snowstorms, ice storms. Yeah, like heat wave. Just pick where you want to be, you know. Yeah,
which disaster you want to face.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think fires are probably one of the ones you can prepare a lot for, you know.
We know a lot of people lost their houses on the North Shore. Obviously, they would like to rebuild or perhaps sell their lot. What are people faced with? There must be an emotional toll and a lot of stress involved. Do you share that experience with those people?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had a lot of clients who we sold houses there that have lost houses. And so, you know,
and now we're trying to help them find houses.
Yeah, in some cases, I mean, there's so many different situations and so many different scenarios. First of all, were they insured? Not everybody was insured. So that makes a big difference. How well their insurance was and how expensive their rebuild is. So people who were in some areas of Scotch Creek where it was flat and they, you know, burnt down, that's not as hard geotechnically to deal with. They still have to test all of the groundwater. They have to check all the septic systems because a lot of those exploded because the gases got heated up. They have to check the soil to make sure there's no contaminants that burnt and soaked into the soil before they rebuild. Once they pass all of that and they know kind of what they're working with, and then it's them deciding, do they want to rebuild knowing that it's all burnt around them? It doesn't look the same anymore. Or do they want out of there? Was it their principal residence, or was this just a lake cottage for them in the summertime? You know, how long had their family been there? Maybe it was a rental property. All these things come into play on what people are doing. And in one scenario, we've got clients who had a house that was on quite a steep slope. And so now when they look at the cost of rebuilding that house on a slope, potentially facing future mudslides and all of the engineering then that's considering all those things, they said, you know, do we really want to rebuild here? And they said, no, you know, I think we're just going to keep the lot. We're going to take a payout. We're going to find a house somewhere else and not have to deal with, you know, the rebuilds, because everybody's waiting on permits right now. A lot of them could not be in houses for another 2 years or so. And so living in limbo like that is what we notice takes the largest psychological toll on people, is the unknown. It's like, okay, my house is getting built. It's going to be ready by this date. Great. Or, okay, I'm buying a new house. I found a new house. I'm going to move in at this date. But the unknown, where they don't know if they're going to get a new house, they don't know if they can rebuild, they don't know what the insurance company is going to do, that's the hardest part for them. It's just navigating through that. A lot of people, if they've got family and stuff supporting them, that's good. But it's people who are on their own, maybe elderly, they've lost their spouse and it's just them. Those are the ones that definitely have a hard time facing all of this stuff.
Did you have any foresight of any of that? Or was this all brand new?
Certain things. We've dealt with people who have lost a house in the fire before, and they definitely ask a lot of weird questions we thought were weird at the time. Now we're like, well, those are not so weird. And, you know, they had a very different way of looking at houses and looking at what could burn around them and how they cared about the materials, like very particular about things all of a sudden. We've had people, you know, report how challenging insurance companies are and things like that. We already knew with some of the lakeshore properties when we were selling them, we'd tell people, look, there's no thing saying like they used to be grandfathered in, but now if you buy this property and it's on a very tiny lot between the lake and the road, you can't conform to the new regulations if you were to try and rebuild. First of all, if this was an empty lot, you wouldn't be allowed to rebuild here. So now the question is, if something happens to this house, we don't know the answer because it hadn't been challenged before if you could rebuild or not. And so I would tell people that and say, look, this is a risk that potentially, if something happened to this house, we didn't know what, that you might not be able to put it back here. Like, are you okay with that risk? And some people were and some people weren't. But that was something we did bring up to people. And now that is what we're seeing, is the jury's still out on whether those tiny lakeshore lots will be allowed to rebuild or not. And it's a very big issue. And nobody wants to make a decision, because if the government makes the decision to say, yes, we're going to give you a hardship variance and allow you to rebuild, first of all, they have to figure out the engineering of it to be within the riparian zone and to put in septic systems that are compliant with no room. And especially if you've got a lot that's all rock, like, how are you going to do that? How is that going to look? And what precedent is that going to set going forward? And the other thing is, if they don't allow them to rebuild, what precedent is that going to set? How are they going to be compensated for this? Because the value is in the land and not the house structure, and insurance is not going to pay you out. So is the government going to pay people out on the land, or how is that going to work? And in the future, what does this do to the value of other properties of houses standing on them that are like this? Is their value going to go down because people are going to go, we know that house has got a lifespan, that it won't be able to be rebuilt if something happens to it, so we're not even going to touch it. And then that seller can't sell. So there's no answers yet. And everybody we've asked, all the builders, all the planners, all the government, the CSRD, nobody's got an answer yet that is public knowledge. So everything is still being worked out right now. So we're going to see.
Do you find that prospective buyers now are asking questions that lead into what will happen if?
Mm-hmm. And also just, you know, like, what's the insurance cost here? Can I get insurance here? I heard it's going to be $10,000 a year. Like, they are very up to date on that stuff in this area now. And they want to know the resale. Has it affected resale?
What are the upsides? We've talked a lot about some of the pitfalls and issues, but what keeps you in the business?
The happy clients, especially when you help people. You know, we just had a family recently buy a, you know, their first recreational property. They're from Alberta, and now they're going to be coming out here, you know, every summer, and, you know, all their family memories, and you hear them start talking about, oh yeah, we're going to put a tree fort there, and when Auntie so-and-so comes, like, this is where we're going to have the beach chairs, we're going to have margarita hour, and, like, you know, the boat, and, like, they're happy. And when you go, when you see people and you drive along the road around the lake in the Shuswap in the summertime, whether it's Blind Bay Road, Sunny Bray, Squilax Angamon, Eagle Bay Road, there's nothing but people on vacation and they're having a great time. And you can see all the toys and all the boats and the dogs and the kids and all those little slow turtle signs, kids crossing signs, like, and you smell sunscreen and barbecue. And to be a part of that is amazing. And to be a part of, you know, people buying their first house, people downsizing, people making money on investment property, all of those things. When people call you and tell you how much of an impact your service has made on their life, because a house, it's a home if they're living there, or it's a part of, you know, their investment strategy or whatever, but it's a huge chunk of where people spend their time. And if they're happy there, their life is overall better. And if you can be a part of that, that's a pretty big deal. Yeah.
And made a lot of friends out of it too.
Tons of friends.
We help find places and they end up calling you up and want to take you out for dinner or something like that.
Yeah. And interesting people. You know, in a lot of industries, you might only deal with the people in that industry. But in real estate, you deal with homeowners, which are in every industry. So you can be dealing with, maybe in the morning you're talking to some teachers, and in the afternoon your client is a geologist, or, you know, whatever. Like, they're all in different fields and different. You learn stuff from your clients. I think that's a big one for me. I love learning.
And their cats and dogs.
Yeah, and their cats and dogs. You meet all of their cats and dogs.
That's their family.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, first name basis with all the cats and dogs.
Yeah, that's my job.
Yeah.
So how much time do you spend in the office versus out looking and selling?
I would say in the day, most of the time you're out of the office, and at night you're in the office, or early in the morning you're in the office or working from home. You usually set up on the couch with a laptop.
Our office is wherever we are, to be honest. Shalon's got her Starlink for when we're up in Seymour Arm and off the grid. And a lot of times I'm driving and she's got the laptop open and we're both talking on phones. And I don't even think we've ever talked to each other in the car at the same time. After like 12 hours on the road, you're like, okay, see you later.
Yeah.
Nice knowing you.
One of the reasons I ask is because you've got a lovely storefront here.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to talk about the table.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The table, for those who are listening, is a wooden table covered in epoxy.
Yeah.
And it looks like there's a river running through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume these are salmon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is so cool. And there's right around the edge, you've got rocks.
Yeah.
All the pebbles of the river.
Yeah, and those are, everything's pretty much sourced from locally around here. And this is the second version of this table. The first one is in our Sorrento office, and it's only a 10-foot table. And it was actually made from a log that was floating around in the lake for a number of years, and finally it washed up on somebody's beach, and they planed it up. And then a friend that I knew had it, and he's like, I'm thinking about, you know, doing some tables. And I said, well, that's funny. I need a table for my office boardroom. And I said, can you make it so, you know, the log edges of the wood come together like a kind of a riverbed? And I said, and then I want to have salmon going down it. And I'd seen these salmon. It's a local artist out of Heffley Lake that makes them.
So no trees or fish were killed in the production.
That's true. Yeah. We've had a lot of gatherings here, you know, not just meetings, but we've had a lot of birthday parties and breakfasts and all sorts of stuff that we, you know, have with the crew and everything like that. So, yeah.
And the maps that are on your walls?
Yeah, we had those made by a local company, a lady. Her company is called Mighty Owl Mapping, and here in Salmon Arm. And we said, you know, what we'd like is all of Salmon Arm in maps and all the properties and all the zoning kind of labels and stuff like that. So it was a lengthy project, but yeah, we were super happy with how it came out. So it's not all in order because Salmon Arm isn't going a line like that. And that's what we had for the wall, but it is all there. So all the city limits. So now that these are like 2 years old, they might be outdated already.
How did houses go from $100,000 or $200,000 to over $1 million seemingly overnight?
Yeah. When I started in 2016, a very average price in Blind Bay was $350,000 to $450,000 for a house. And that was your 1980s needed some work. If you wanted all the bells and whistles, a really nice house, it was $600,000. That was, I thought I was really doing well when I sold my first $600,000 house. And yeah, that was kind of coming out of the downfall after the 2008 recession. The bottom of the market was basically 2013. And then things slowly started to kind of, the prices didn't start moving a whole, they just started selling in, you know, 2014, 2015, 2016. Not fast. The prices were pretty low. 2018, 19, we started to see prices going up. And it was very hard for a lot of people to kind of understand it because they'd just, the sting of 2008 was very real still.
Well, I think a big factor in that question is a lot to do with the cost of building a house. Mm-hmm. Over time, labor costs went from, you know, 20 years ago to where it is today. Material costs, things got a lot more technical, like much more improved type of systems in houses, better finishes than they had in like back in the 70s and stuff like that. And then the land value just kind of goes up as the supply.
Yeah, the cost diminishes. Permits, the cost of all of the systems, like, you know, everything from the water systems and wells and septic systems and materials, like during the supply shortage, all of a sudden when everybody saw drywall and plywood and all those things just skyrocket because we didn't have any, and projects that were already started, like they had ordered it. And so what was there was worth a premium. So like everything just went way up, and people for a while could pay it because the interest rates were so low. It didn't make sense. The prices were pretty crazy, but we had way more demand and not enough supply. And Canada as a whole is in a huge housing supply shortage. And that's been our problem. That's been exacerbating over the years. So it kind of all came to a head. And now you see average family home, $1 million plus GST. Yeah, for a new build. Yeah.
And like you said earlier, people can live out in the country and work. So even rural areas are not exempt from high prices, high value.
We saw a lot of out-of-town people move in,
You know, another factor in that, I think that every single person who has a house that wants to sell it wants to get as much as they possibly can for it. So over time, I think that compounds, right?
A lot of people's retirement is in their house.
Yeah.
And then we had people, our buyers during the boom were coming up from Vancouver because the Vancouver market was largely foreign buyers buying for high prices. And then the Vancouver buyers, Vancouver got called the city of millionaires for a few years there because that's what was happening there. And so they were coming here, and a price that was on a house here that no local would pay, all of a sudden somebody from Vancouver was like, well, compared to what I sold my house for, this is cheap. And so they were kind of driving the prices up too. And then we don't have the supply here for the amount of demand coming. So then people were like, oh, I'll give you my house, but at this price. And people were like, okay, sure. And just to get a house. And then once you had those price precedents established, then even when the supply chain normalized, you know, labor is still expensive. There's still a lot of, you know, more components. The STEP code in energy efficiency and stuff like that makes a house very expensive to build when it has to be this very seal tight unit. So a number of factors.
Are there houses that are becoming obsolete in that they don't conform to certain codes, or they're just not energy efficient enough?
Yeah, we've been seeing it a little bit now, like these people who built these little off the grid type of cabin houses with straw bales or log ends or kind of less than normal materials, and also houses that are in the over 25 year age range with certain type of roofing shingles or plumbing stuff. The insurance agencies and the mortgage companies are putting so much pressure on them because they're considering those properties higher risk, that those properties then are not selling, not because people don't want them, but people can't buy them because they can't get it mortgaged or insured. And therefore, then all of a sudden they have to discount them to sell them to a cash buyer at a really low price. And so it doesn't incentivize or encourage people to do more of those houses because they can't get out of them sometimes. So, yeah.
Is there an advantage to having like solar power in your house?
Yes, it's becoming more of a thing now for sure. And some people hearing like there's a lot of, I don't know if it's the rebates, but the incentives, I guess, for if you put solar panels on your house and then basically the cost up front is nothing, and you're paying it off in your power bill. So when you, throughout the summer, instead of it doesn't go into a battery bank, but it feeds into the system and then it creates a credit for you. And in the winter, then you're working off, like your bills are being deducted off your credit that's being building up over the summer. And part of that charge is also the charge for the installation of the solar panels. And so in that instance, like, I'm seeing a few people do that, not a whole lot yet, which is kind of surprising, but there's people that it makes total sense. And there's people around here that are saying that they have almost no power usage all summer. They're able to run an entire household off of solar, and then they've got a credit built up. So even in the winter time when they're using power, that credit's still really coming into play. So it can make a lot of sense, like not in every scenario and not on every house, but there's some that it definitely does. Yeah.
What's happening with houses that have wood heat? Is wood heat on its way out in terms of not being able to get insurance or stuff like that?
It's a really good question because it's a big thing right now. They're having troubles with insurance. Insurance companies would rather prefer you do not have wood heat in your house. They want electric heat or natural gas heat all day long. They don't want wood heat because they consider it a higher risk factor. But buyers want the ability to burn wood heat, especially in rural areas, because January, New Year's Day 2020, we had that big snowstorm at the end of 2019, and we had some places around here without power for 7 days because of the amount of snow. And luckily, it wasn't that cold. It was only, you know, maybe around zero. But if it had been cold, those people didn't have power. They only have wood or electric. And if there's no electric and they've got no wood, they had no option but to leave their houses. They wouldn't even be able to keep themselves warm. And so out here in rural areas, wood is a big thing. People move out here. A lot of people put wood fireplaces in, and they're very adamant about it. So it's going to be a big push of people pushing back and saying, no, we want wood heat. It's in abundance. It's free. We can always keep ourselves warm if we need it. But insurance companies just look at it from a risk profile, and they don't like it. So it's hard to say. Like, it's not encouraged. You don't see it in town and new builds, which makes sense. But in this, like, outerlying areas where you could be potentially snowed in or have no power for a few days, it makes a lot of sense.
Do you find that it's a bonus to have a fireplace in a house?
Yes, because you can always not use it or take it out. Mm-hmm. But to put it in an existing house, super expensive most of the time. Pellet stoves are a little bit cheaper, and a lot of people do that, but otherwise, to put in a full chimney and stuff like that is not always cheap. So, yeah, I think it's something that people don't want to leave or move away from, especially if they've experienced it. Maybe if they never have, they don't know what they're missing. But if they have, it's a big thing. Yeah.
Do you find that you've met your neighbors on either side?
Mm-hmm.
And you hang out with them at all?
Yeah. Yeah, they generally come over and harass us a bit, and we go over and harass them a bit.
Yeah. I always phone up Hungry Panda and say, they answer, Hungry Panda, and I go, it's Hungry Gourd.
Yeah. a lot of times we're, you know, down at the candy vault, or we're up at Pink Cherry, or everybody, whenever the realtors are like in town, you know, the question is like, oh, what are you having for lunch today? And everybody's always, you know, going for a different place for lunch. And not only lunch, like you know, you can run across the street and get a facial or a tan or whatever you want, or go for a float, or like there's so many things that it's cool. So
I went next door to Red Threads to buy a gift card to donate to Lobster Fest the other day,
mm-hmm,
for their auction.
Yeah, so we do a lot of that stuff too. We try and support them. We try to get a lot of our client gifts locally too, like in the downtown core, and source them from around here too. So yeah, that helps as well.
Are you involved in business real estate?
Yes. We do some commercial real estate as well. It's not our main focus. I'd say we're primarily residential and recreational and farm, but we do commercial as well. So we've done everything from marinas to motels to grocery stores to pizza restaurants. So there's been a few different ones, and just some like buildings. And one of the cool ones I helped with a little while ago was a lease for a guy opening a do-it-yourself mechanic place in Sorrento, and he's opening up, and it's apparently a big thing in other areas, but you can come in and pay an hourly rate and work on your own vehicle. So if you want to do your own oil changes and everything, they have all the tools there. You just take the tools, you check the tools out, you can work on your vehicle, and that's one rate. Or you can have the mechanic who's there help you a little bit, and that's another rate. Or you can have them totally do it for you like a normal mechanic place too. So I thought that's kind of a really cool business. Yeah.
I understand there's a house in Tappan that's famous. do you know about that house? It has an Egyptian pyramid or something like that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any dealings with that
property? I've been in it. It's very cool. It is very, very unique. It's very cool. That house has an accepted offer at this point in time. We'll probably know sometime this summer whether it's sold. But yeah, it's an extremely unique property, and it's a lot of people have wanted to see what's going on there. I've been to it, and it's cool, yeah.
And when was that house built?
I feel like it was a 1990s house, I think, yeah. I got to go back and check, but I think it was in the 1990s, yeah.
And has it been on the market before? Or?
This is the first time that I'm aware that it's ever been on the market. And I think, when did it come on the market? Last year?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it came on last year, so it's been on until now, so a little while.
It's pretty amazing.
It's very amazing.
I did a virtual tour through it, and it's just fascinating. Just you could just live in the pyramid alone.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'd never heard of it, and here it is on the New York Post and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I'll have to look that up. Like recently on the New York Post?
I think so, yeah. Mm.
Well, when I was a kid and Google Maps first came out, or Google Earth first came out, and kids knew that this, and then people would kind of zoom down, and all you could see was this pyramid structure and nothing else. And so kids were always like, oh my God, what do you think is there? And like, yeah, it was always a thing when I was a kid, yeah, people talked about.
Is there anything that we've missed that you would like the people of Salmon Arm to know?
I think that a lot of times people don't ask enough questions, or they assume that real estate is like when you watch any show and you're like, well, that's how it must be in a hospital, or that's how it must be in a lawyer's office. Mm-hmm. And real estate's the same. There's a lot of misconceptions, I think. People don't fully understand how it works. And our industry has got a lot of nuance in it. And so I think the biggest thing that we find is trying to educate people and get them to don't be afraid to ask questions. Just because you ask a realtor questions doesn't mean you have to like use them and you're not locked in, but you can just phone them up and ask them questions. Like most realtors are happy to just tell you about how things work. When people go to list a house, they often interview a couple different realtors. And I always tell people, okay, but how do you know the questions to ask that realtor even? Like maybe ahead of time, make sure you know the questions to even ask too, because there's so much variety. You'll know who you feel comfortable with, but also at the same time, like somebody who has a local knowledge and track record and has sold in maybe your building before or things like that, they really matter. And so, yeah, just sometimes, you know, maybe asking your realtor the questions you should even be asking other realtors is not a bad thing too. So,
yeah. And for me, it would be, I think a lot of people think that realtors are like salespeople, but we're far from it. And one example I like to give is that the difference between, say, a car salesman that works on a car dealership is that car salesman works for the dealership. Well, we don't work for anybody. We work for the client, whether you're selling the house or you're buying the house. That's who our employers are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think people realize that a lot of times. Yeah.
Why would a person choose to sell their home by themselves without a realtor?
I think a variety of reasons. When I've seen people sell their homes themselves, either they're the owner of the home, they'll know the property best, maybe they haven't had a great experience with a realtor, and so they didn't see the value in them, so there's definitely that. Sometimes they just want to save the commission because they don't see that they're getting value for what they're paying in commission. And sometimes, you know, their neighbor sold their house really easy by themselves, and, you know, maybe they think, yeah, why not give it a go? Sometimes they're ex-realtors or something within that industry that they go, you know, I'm just going to do it on my own. So a variety of reasons. Sometimes it works out really well, just like anything. Sometimes it doesn't. It's kind of a mixed bag.
You're at a slight disadvantage, though. You know, we have the advantage of the MLS. So you're getting thousands of people that are viewing it.
They can still be on, like, for sale by owners can be like with, you know, like a service like Property Guys or something. They can be on the MLS. But what I find a lot of times is we have internal systems. So when you reach out to a realtor and say, hey, I'm asking about this property, we have an internal system that sends them a message. And that realtor, if they don't get back to you right away, they're incentivized because they don't make money if they don't sell the property. So they're getting back to you straight away and they're saying, oh yeah, like it's this property. And if you've worked with realtors before, you develop relationships, you know, hey, this realtor always has great information about the property. They know everything they're talking about. This is going to be awesome. I can get everything I need. When you're dealing with a homeowner, you don't know them. So the trust, you have to establish that, whether they are telling the truth or, you know, trustworthy. And a lot of times they are, but you don't know. You don't know if they are going to be, you know, wanting to work with a realtor. And you don't know, you know, how you're going to be negotiating your own pay as well as trying to negotiate a deal for your client. So it can be a little bit challenging. And they don't always respond right away, too. Like a realtor will usually, you know, respond all the time quickly. Mm-hmm. But a homeowner, if they're working all day, they
might
not. I think
they just don't know what they don't know, right? The liabilities that they can face selling their home, that maybe because we're educated on what to disclose and all the things behind, you know, covenants and right-of-ways and easements and charges on title and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that they could be not, you know, up to speed on, that could come back and bite them, right?
And a lot of people think it's no big deal, just get a lawyer to write it up. Well, if the lawyer's never seen the property and the lawyer's not, like, that's not their job to do real estate. They do the conveyancing portion of it, which is all the legal title conveyancing, but they're not there to say, is there an encroachment over there? Or, like, looks like some soil erosion happening here. Looks like you're having some issues with your well over here. Like, that's not their job. They don't write that in. Like, they can only protect you as far as what they know. And if that's not their day-to-day what they do, doesn't mean that a lawyer is going to be the most knowledgeable about property sale. That's why there's realtors, I guess.
How would a potential buyer or seller contact Fair Realty?
Well, realtors are probably the easiest people to find because we have our faces everywhere with our names and numbers. So you usually just Google their name if you need their number, and it's all over online. If you stop by the office, all of our signed listings, we've always got our numbers there. So we're pretty easy to get a hold of. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, you name it.
Like, we'll try to call them before they call us.
That's a new talent.
We think you're going to be thinking about selling, so we're just preemptively calling you. Yeah.
Just save them the quarter.
Yeah. So yeah, usually if you just stroll down to a real estate office and you start, you know, or like get online is a great way, because you can learn a lot about that agent by looking through their social media and getting a feel for their personality and how they present houses and everything like that. So it's like, you know, you can look at their credentials by looking at how they present, you know, their listings and everything like that ahead of time.
Reviews.
And their reviews. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do reviews. Yeah. So that's a good way to check people out.
And people could always stop by.
Yeah, they can always stop by. Yeah. And if nobody's here, there's always our number on the office, and all of the agents' numbers are on the window too. So you can just call one up anytime. Yeah.
So you're at 161 Hudson.
161 Hudson. Yeah. The yellow building.
Well, thank you very much, both of you.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's been interesting.
That's good.
Really nice.
And educational.
Yeah.
Very educational. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.